Good morning. I want to welcome you all here for our first case of the February sitting. I apologize for my voice and hacking cough, and I will do the best I can under these circumstances. So, the case this morning is State v. Dundon, 97-1423 CR. Mr. Coleman is Assistant State Public Defender representing Mr. Dundon, and you will begin the argument, sir.
May it please the court, I am William Coleman and I'm representing Mr. Dundon. The Court of Appeals certified this case to the court, asking the court to determine first whether a privilege defense applies to the crime of carrying a concealed weapon, and if it does, what its elements are. Mr. Dundon contends that a privilege defense does apply, and its elements are those the court defined as a defense to the crime of felon in possession of a firearm in the recent decision of State versus Coleman. Mr. Dundon asked for a new trial where he would be permitted to present evidence material to the privilege defense, argue the privilege defense to the jury, have the jury be instructed on that defense. Mr. Dundon was the manager of a gas station in Milwaukee. The gas station had an agreement with the Armored Car Service to pick up the money every day. The Armored Car Service failed to do that for five straight days, and this resulted in the safe at the gas station becoming full, and the monies that were then being received having no place to be secured. Mr. Dundon had to decide what to do. He could either let the money continue to come in and have no place to secure it. He felt this was not a viable option in his terms because he felt it would endanger the safety of himself and his employees at the gas station. So instead, he chose to remove the money from the gas station and take it to the bank himself. The bank that the gas station used was about a mile away. So he got in his car. First he packed up the money, got in his car, and he took with him his pistol, which he lawfully owns.
And what does it mean, lawfully owns?
Well, it was registered to him, okay. Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
What time of the day or evening was this?
This was during the daylight, during business hours on a Thursday. I believe it was a Thursday morning. Mr. Dundon had the pistol on it, the front seat of his car in a one-mile trip.
Now, let me ask counsel, as far as having the pistol on the front seat, there is a case, and I can't think of it, that says that if the pistol is on the front seat, that itself is, is concealing a weapon just by having a pistol sitting. Is that correct?
There is case law to that effect.
Yes.
That it would be hidden from ordinary observation.
So you're not debating that?
No, Your Honor.
Well, what was the evidence that it was concealed in the car or concealed on him? Were both elements or both fact situations before the jury, or just that it was on his belt?
Well, the facts supporting the theory that it was concealed while in his car was in evidence. There was testimony as well that once he left his car in the bank parking lot, that it was concealed by his clothing in the parking lot and in the bank. The state argued that was concealment, even believing Mr. Dundon's testimony. Mr. Dundon testified and acknowledged that the gun was at least partially concealed by his clothing or by his belt while he was in the parking lot of the bank and while he was in the bank.
Now, how else, just so I'm trying to imagine, because as I understand the law, you can have a weapon as long as it's not concealed, correct, in the state of Wisconsin. So how else would he have, if he had it in his hand, I mean, the argument could be made it would be partially concealed. If he stuck it in his belt, the same argument could be made. So I was just trying to imagine how would you handle a pistol that would not be partially concealed?
I've tried to imagine that myself, Your Honor, and I think in almost any circumstance that might be deemed to be partially concealed, and that's why concealment is almost always a question for the jury to decide whether on the facts in the case a weapon is hidden from ordinary observation. The district attorney argued that even accepting Mr. Dundon's testimony that the jury should convict Mr. Dundon because they argued that he acknowledged at least a partial concealment of the weapon while he was in the bank, and that was enough to convict him.
Let me understand clearly what your position is. Are you conceding there was at least a partial concealment here?
That was the testimony, that the gun was not completely exposed. That was Mr. Dundon's testimony. There's no dispute that there was at least a partial concealment in this case.
So if he doesn't have a privilege, then he's guilty, and the evidence would so show. Is that right?
And that's exactly what the state argued, and that is either it was concealed, then he was guilty. And that was argued very vigorously to the jury, which was not permitted to consider whether Mr. Dundon had some sort of justification to do what he did, to commit a technical violation of the law, at least through a partial concealment of a pistol.
Well, your defense, as I understand it, is using the Coleman case and basically the statute that has this any crime defense. In other words, what we call the catch-all phrase. As I read that what little transcript we had, you were not allowed to put in any, let's say, offer of proof. You said you wanted to make a record on any of those issues, and even to the point, as I understand it, to discuss why your client might have done certain things. Have I overstated that or not?
I think that's a fair statement, Your Honor, that some evidence that would be material to a privileged defense did seep into the record, but it was only through the very persistent efforts of the defense attorney to get that in, and the trial judge was apparently of a view that there was no sort of justification defense here, and he went so far as to threaten to hold Mr. Dundon's attorney in contempt should he persist in his efforts to try to present this testimony. And that threat had its intended effect, I'm sure, of chilling Mr. Dundon's attorney from trying to present that anymore. Although he did ask for an instruction at the close of the evidence on the necessity defense based upon how that defense is defined under federal common law. And alternatively, he asked also for the Wisconsin jury instruction on necessity. Both of those requests were denied. Again, the judge seeming to voice the view that as a matter of law, there was no privileged defense to carrying a concealed weapon. Essentially, it's an absolute liability offense, is what he seemed to be of a view.
Mr. Coleman, do you see a difference between the... I think we're having some trouble. Do you see a difference between the State versus Coleman privilege that you talked about when you first got up and the necessity privilege?
No, Your Honor, I think the privilege defined in Coleman is, in effect, has its origins in the necessity privilege. In fact, I think the court relied upon primarily the federal decision in United States versus Gant, which did discuss it at great length, the common law defense of necessity, that is a choice between evils in which a person is permitted to commit at least a technical violation of the law where the harm that results from the violation is less than the harm that would cause if he did not commit the violation. It's often referred to as lesser evils, and that philosophy is well established in Wisconsin as well. The lesser evils defense is discussed in numerous decisions of this court and the Court of Appeals.
Well, the state in this particular case, as I understand it, has indicated that if we decide that the State versus Coleman privilege is applicable here, that we'd have to modify it. What do you think about that? What is your position on that?
As I read the brief, it appeared to me that the state was requesting more of a clarification than a modification. I didn't discern that the state's request amounted to any substantive change in the defense as it's defined in Coleman.
I thought they wanted the or to read and in that first element, both a subjective and objective test.
Right, and I think that it's clear from the test that it is a conjunctive requirement. It does require both a subjective and objective, and we would have no opposition to that sort of clarification if the court deemed it was necessary. But I don't think it substantively changes that element in Coleman.
Now, Coleman came in under 6, 939.456, as I understand it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're asking for it under 939.451 or 939.47, which is the necessity. Necessity is mentioned in both. Is that correct?
Well, actually, Your Honor, we're asking that the privileged defense to carrying a concealed weapon also be recognized under the subparagraph 6, which is, which I've described as a residual privilege exception. I think that would be appropriate, as it was appropriate in Coleman.
Well, do you have any keys? Is there a statute that recognizes a privilege, you're asking? Because it says when, for any other reason, the actor's conduct is privileged by the statutory or common law of the state. You don't have a statute, right?
No, Your Honor. The statute, by its terms, seems to be limited to circumstances that are created by natural physical forces. So I think a strict reading of the statute makes it unavailable, although the court has applied some of the statutory defenses in situations that did not perfectly fit the elements of those statutory defenses. I think this is such a case.
Are you dropping your argument that 939.47 necessity is not applicable, or is applicable?
I think the strict terms of that statute are probably not met in this case.
The physical forces term.
Right.
So actually, at least what I hear you saying, counsel, and I to follow up the chief's question, what you're saying is you have to rely on 939.45 sub 6.
I think so, Your Honor, unless the court were to read the necessity defense in the statute to be broader than the natural physical forces, which is a common law.
That's your if all else fails argument. I understand that. But with respect to sub 6, since you're not you're hoping that maybe you can sell us on sub 7 or on necessity, but it sounds to me as if you're saying you are relying on the common law of the state, because the sub 6 only gives you two choices, statutory or common law.
And that's largely correct. And the common law is the Coleman defense, which is essentially a necessity defense, a necessity or coercion defense.
Mm-hmm.
Coleman mentions that the defenses to the crime of felon in possession are called a number of things throughout the number of jurisdictions: necessity, coercion, choice of evils. The court in Coleman declines to label the defense it defined in Coleman, but I think if you look at the underlying rationale, it is at bottom a necessity defense in Coleman.
It's called it a privilege in Coleman. It doesn't say precisely what kind, right?
Yes, sir. Okay.
Is there evidence as to other possible alternatives in the record, such as that your client could have called for help from the bank for security, or they could have called the normal truck company that did their security transferring of money and have them come out on demand and do it? Is there anything in the record according to, about that?
There is some, Your Honor, but not much, because the court didn't allow that questioning. But there was a question posed: why didn't you? Actually, Mr. Dundon did testify that he called the Armored Car Service every day. They didn't appear. The day before he went to the bank, he called them twice, and they promised to come. They didn't come. He was asked why he didn't call the police. He was not permitted to answer that question upon objection that was sustained. So there, some evidence did seep into the record, but a lot of it was excluded upon the state's objections to the testimony.
Do you need intent when you have concealed, when the charge is concealed weapon? And let's suppose I carrying this weapon quite open in my arms, and all of a sudden a wind blows and, you know, some paper or cloth comes and conceals the weapon. And there I am carrying a concealed weapon. Am I liable?
I think there is some sort of scienter requirement with the crime, Your Honor. That is, the jury instruction says awareness of the presence of the weapon. Whether an accidental or inadvertent concealment subjects one to liability, I think, is not terribly clear from the case law. There's language in State versus Asper that says inadvertence precludes concealment, and I've read that case a number of times, and frankly, I'm having a difficult time determining in my own mind whether that allows for an accidental concealment or not. Mr. Dundon testified that he didn't conceal it, which would lead one to conclude that if it did become concealed somehow, that concealment was accidental. But again, concealment is at bottom for the jury to decide. It's an issue of fact.
Let me just follow this, because if I understand the state's argument in the red brief, basically page 14 and 15, they're saying clearly that even if you assume that the privilege established by this court in Coleman is equally applicable to the carrying a concealed weapon charge, that your facts don't meet it. And then the state said that we don't want to hear those facts. In other words, that seems to be the guts of the argument, that even though you recognize there is a possible privilege under the catch-all clause, that there was a lack of opportunity to put anything in on the record under the offer of proof for making the record. That's what I see as the crunch of this, as far as this court is concerned. Is that the way that you look at it, or do you think that, because they're saying, regardless, your facts don't meet any privilege. You just don't have it here.
That's how I perceive their argument as well, Your Honor. I happen to think, in the first instance, that although defense counsel is stymied at every turn from putting evidence in, I think there's enough in here for the court to rule that at least a jury should decide whether the elements of the Coleman defense have been met.
Well, with respect to that first element, counsel, let me ask you this. Let us assume that no reasonable person could have believed that there was an actual threat of harm. Just as a matter of law, this would. But everybody believes that Mr. Dundon held that belief. This goes somewhat to the clarification that the state has requested. Do you believe that the fact that Mr. Dundon held that belief is sufficient to pass the first test?
No, Your Honor, I think there does have to be an objectively reasonable.
So you agree with the state that there has to be an objectively reasonable, and Mr. Dundon had to have that fear?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, what was the objectively reasonable fear of imminent threat?
The dangerous circumstances that existed at the gas station. Convenience store in the city of Milwaukee, loose cash laying around, employees being aware of this.
Oh, that would go to keeping a gun on the premises, but I think, at least as I read this statute, the imminent threat has to pertain to the point when he was carrying the concealed weapon, i.e., when he was transporting the money from the gas station to the bank, and actually into the bank. And I know that you've said high crime, but what is the imminency of the threat here? I mean, at least under your theory, it seems to me anybody carrying money in their wallet could claim imminent threat because and therefore carry a concealed weapon.
I think, Your Honor, that the short duration of and the confluence of a lot of circumstances here gave Mr. Dundon a reasonable apprehension that there was a threat. to him when he was transporting.
But what was that threat, counsel? Unless somebody knew that he was carrying that kind of money, and at least as far as I know, you do not say that, you know, this was common knowledge that he was carrying money. How is he different from any other citizen carrying $10 in their wallet?
Because, Your Honor, other persons knew that money was accumulating at the gas station. And that is, the employees knew that. And if other persons knew that he had this large sum of money on him, which they did, that created and gave rise to objective facts of a threat during his very short journey between the gas station. He was with that weapon only for as long as he possibly had to be.
Is that part of the record that other people knew?
He testified that his employees were aware of this overflow.
Counsel,
go ahead.
Wasn't the testimony that they were aware that there was money in overflow in the safe, as opposed to just exactly what Justice Babbage is focusing on, the imminent danger, to prevent imminent danger at the time that he was carrying a concealed weapon? My sense is this, that what Justice Babbage is focusing on is exactly what the post-conviction judge stated. That is, there may be a privilege. Assuming he was allowed to present evidence, there's no way that they can sustain, the defendant can sustain, that he was under an unlawful, present, imminent, and impending threat. I mean, that's the problem, isn't it?
That's probably the most problematic element. But the reasonableness of Mr. Dundon's belief is also a jury question.
Did you have any more testimony relating to the imminent danger, an impending threat, at the time that he was carrying the concealed weapon?
What counsel was able to suggest by his questions was that it was a high crime area. Mr. Dundon wasn't permitted to expand on that. Mr. Dundon wasn't permitted to explain circumstances of him being set up in a previous employment situation when he was departing his workplace. He was not permitted to answer questions about that.
What? Was it in the same area?
It wasn't.
Or a different neighborhood? Not clear on the record.
I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay.
He wasn't permitted to testify to that.
What? I'm sorry. Please.
That's right. Did I understand Justice Babbage asked something about the defendant having a gun on the premises? Would that be lawful?
I think there is a statutory exception to that. It might be lawful. There's no evidence that that was done in this case at all, or as a matter of policy. So there's no evidence of a gun being present on the premises of the gas station in this case, Your Honor.
But
I think there is a statutory provision that would allow a pistol on the premises of a store that sells beverages. And frankly, I'm not sure that this store, it's not in the record whether it sold alcoholic beverages. What I was thinking about was sort of a tavern keeper's exception, and I'm not sure whether that would even be lawful, actually. Your Honor, we're asking
this bank had been robbed. Had been bank robbery, this very bank, is that right?
Well, that's, again, counsel attempted to ask. Mr. Dundon did testify that it had been robbed previously. When, under what circumstances, wasn't permitted to go into. He attempted to ask the bank employees, the bank manager, and the security guard about that, and was not permitted to ask those questions.
So, and that he personally, your client personally, if I get this correctly, had been robbed or was around someone who had been?
He had been previously a victim of a robbery in connection with his departing his workplace.
Right.
The circumstances of that he was not permitted to go into.
Was there an offer of proof submitted?
Counsel tried valiantly to make one, and the trial judge threatened him with contempt, and he then ceased in his efforts to make the offer.
Did he actually use the words offer of proof to the judge?
I believe he has to make a record. He has to be allowed to make a record, was his language, Your Honor.
Was he asking to do that outside of the presence of the jury?
Not expressly, but I think that was implicit in his request, Your Honor.
Counsel, again, I focus on the difference between danger and imminent danger. The post-conviction judge defined imminent as threatening to occur very soon. What testimony did you have to offer, or do you think exists or could exist, to show that there is danger that was to occur very soon? Not just danger, but to imminent, impending.
Well, the danger was during this period that he was transporting the weapon, which was...
I submit danger. I concede danger. I'm focusing on imminent. What testimony did you want to offer that would show that it was threatening to occur very soon, a real harm, great bodily harm, a real presence of great bodily harm?
While he has that large amount of money... during a short period of time, that is a danger at that short, during that short period of time, that 10 or 15 minute window, the circumstances give rise to a threat. That's why there are armed
guards. Is short danger the same as imminent danger then?
I think under these circumstances, the shortness of the period of his, of him having a weapon is, and having that money is the, does meet the imminence requirement, yes, Your Honor.
Counsel?
I see my time's expired.
Yes. Any other questions? There are no other questions from the bench. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Ms. Herman? You know you can lower the podium, right? Thank you.
I apologize, I may be suffering from the same cold that the Chief Justice is too, so I apologize in advance if I cough or do anything to that effect. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Lara Herman, representing the state of Wisconsin. It is the state's core contention in this appeal that there is no defense of privilege in Wisconsin to the charge of carrying a concealed weapon. Alternatively, if this court agrees with Mr. Dundon that there should be a privilege to the charge of carrying a concealed weapon, then it is the state's position that this court should apply a clarified version of the narrow State versus Coleman privilege. The state would first like to turn to the statutory privileges available in Wisconsin. Privilege in Wisconsin is governed by Wisconsin Statute 939.45. And I don't believe that Mr. Dundon's attorney is arguing any of these statutory privileges with maybe the exception of the necessity privilege, which is governed by Section 939.47. But it's quite clear from the language of the statute that necessity in Wisconsin is limited to situations where there is the pressure of natural physical forces which cause the actor reasonably to believe that his or her act was the only means of preventing imminent public disaster or imminent death or great bodily harm. And I think it is undisputed here that there simply was no physical force at the time that Mr. Dundon carried the concealed weapon. Because none of these specifically enumerated statutory defenses of privilege apply, Mr. Dundon is left with trying to establish a privilege under the catch-all privilege of Section 939.45 sub 6, which, as this Court recognized earlier, requires, it only applies if there is a statutory or common law privilege to carry a concealed weapon in Wisconsin. And I believe that my opponent here has not disputed that there is no statutory privilege in Wisconsin to the charge of carrying concealed weapon. Therefore, he is left with trying to establish that there is a common law privilege in this state to carry a concealed weapon. It is the state's position that this is simply not the case. There is no common law privilege in Wisconsin to carry a concealed weapon.
Ms. Harmon, welcome. I am confused then with that argument because of the statements that occur on page 4 and the top of page 5 of your brief, if you'd refer to that. You said at the bottom of page 4, the last three lines, the state agrees with Dundon that nothing in section 93945 prohibits a defense of privilege as a matter of law to the charge of carrying a concealed weapon. Now, I read that when I read your brief as being a concession, that in fact you could have a privilege under 93945, but it just doesn't apply in this case. And then, of course, we read later in your brief something else. Can you explain what you meant there on the bottom of page 4?
Sure. What I think I meant at the time I wrote my brief was that the circumstances of this case clearly do not fall within any of the specifically enumerated statutory defenses of privilege. It's not coercion, it's not necessity, it's not self-defense, etc., etc. And in fact, the state's position now is even stronger than that. Upon reflection and looking at these statutory defenses of privilege, the state believes that as a matter of law, none of these statutory defenses of privilege really could apply to a charge of carrying a concealed weapon, with maybe the exception of coercion. The state is hard-pressed to come up with a hypothetical situation where someone might be coerced to carry a concealed weapon unless someone is saying, unless you carry this concealed weapon, I'm going to shoot you, or something to that effect, and it just doesn't seem like it really fits.
Okay, then my question, excuse me, I wanted you to finish your answer, but
I think I'm pretty finished with that answer.
My question is that, you know, we're looking at a standard here of judge's erroneous exercise of discretion, basically looking at whether or not, as I understand it, he should have allowed the defendant to make a record. And assuming there was a concession, or at least following up on that question, how would the judge, other than he didn't hear, he wasn't aware of all of the defenses, as I gather, that Mr. Dungeon, the defendant, wanted to make, in not allowing any offer of proof? So we're kind of asking questions as what you would have testified to, and particularly in the area of, quote, necessity, which you're, or the catch-all clause, that this court is left with, well, we would have to say there's an absolute finding by this court that you never could use this in a concealed, carrying a concealed weapon. That's what we're stuck with here. And what I'm striving for is why the state feels that the court could just automatically eliminate any type of record offer of proof.
Well, I guess there are several responses that I'd like to make to that question. First of all, in this particular case, the only defense of privilege that Mr. Dundon's attorney tried to establish at all was necessity. And I think it's clear that the defense of necessity just does not apply, because in Wisconsin, it is not a choice of evils. It is very limited to situations where the pressure of natural physical forces creates a necessity for someone to do the otherwise criminal act. Mr. Dundon's attorney did not make any argument as to a general privilege, did not try and argue under this catch-all privilege. His only argument was under necessity.
I have not read the whole transcript. I've read the briefs that we have here, but it seems to me that he tried, but the judge wouldn't even hear what he had to say. In other words, we're taking sort of a speculative that he would have or couldn't have argued this way, but he didn't have the opportunity, if I understand, to make any argument in that area.
I would disagree, actually. I think my reading of the record suggests that while it's true Mr. Dundon's trial counsel did try to ask some questions that were objected to by the prosecutor, and those objections were sustained, at one point they did, as Mr. Dundon's trial counsel, continue to try and ask questions to get some of these facts in the record. At one point, they did, in fact, go back into chambers to discuss this, and it was there that Mr. Dundon's trial counsel did have a very good opportunity to try and explain what it was he was trying to establish. He tried to explain, this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to establish a defense of necessity.
And that's on the record, in other words?
That is on the record, yes. I don't have an exact cite for you, but through the trial testimony, when Mr. Dundon is testifying, it's there that most of these objections are made, and at some point, they do in fact go off the record outside the presence of the jury, and it's there that Mr. Dundon's trial counsel makes it clear that his only attempt to establish a defensive privilege is by way of the necessity privilege. He doesn't make any general argument as to privilege or any of the other specifically enumerated statutory privileges.
Well, then is your position that he waived the right to argue other privileges because he didn't give the opportunity the trial judge to rule on the evidence in that manner?
I did not specifically make that argument in my brief, but I think that would be a fair argument to make.
Okay. So he didn't ask for necessity. And you and defense counsel appear to agree that necessity under the statutes is narrower than would apply to the facts of this case. Maybe it can be stretched, but for the moment, let's just have an agreement. That still leaves the question, counsel, as to whether there are any other privileges. And that would come under the six, as I understand it, subsection 6. And we've knocked out statutory, so we're now to common law. Is that right?
Right.
And so what's the state's position on that? Is there any common law privilege that relates to this crime, aside from the facts of this case? Just
right,
abstract.
It's the state's position that there is no common law privilege to the charge of carrying a concealed weapon. The state's research revealed certainly no clearly established common law privilege, unlike the situation this court was faced with in Coleman.
Well, in Coleman, it was clearly established maybe under federal law, but not clearly established in Wisconsin.
Right, right.
And you're saying it's not clearly established in Wisconsin or elsewhere as common law.
Right.
That's your position.
Right. I believe I made this point in my brief, but I'd like to elaborate on it here. There are many states that do have some sort of privilege to carry a concealed weapon, but it is within either some of their statutes. Some of the statutes of general defenses of privilege in other states are broader than they are in Wisconsin. Like necessity, for example, is more of a choice of evils type of privilege, but Wisconsin is much more narrow. And several other states, I believe I cited the majority of them in my brief, have some sort of specific statutory privilege within the language of their carrying concealed weapons statute. And Wisconsin does not have that, and the Wisconsin legislature has not seen fit to do so.
Well, you're right, but in the abstract, I'm struck by the almost seeming absurdity, and I want you to address the seeming absurdity is too strong of a word, but if we said that there's a common law privilege, or at least we recognized a common law privilege for a felon in possession of a firearm, the question that comes to my mind, you know, why don't we recognize it? I mean, it seems to make sense to have a privilege for carrying a concealed weapon.
It's the state's position that that is not the case, that there are very distinct differences between felon in possession and between the charge of carrying concealed weapon. And I'll elaborate on those for you here. It's the state's position that a privilege to the charge of felon in possession makes sense because allowing a felon in possession, felons in possession are prohibited as a class from even temporarily possessing weapons, openly or concealed. And the carrying concealed weapon charge prohibits everyone, with the exception of peace officers, from carrying weapons in a concealed manner. But, excuse me, the state's position is that a privilege to the charge of felon in possession makes sense because to temporarily possess a weapon openly advances the goals of self-protection and protection of property. But it's the state's position that a privilege to carry a concealed weapon doesn't really advance any of the goals that it's designed to protect. The carrying of a weapon in a concealed manner isn't really going to deter a would-be robber or assailant because that person has no idea that the person is carrying this weapon. It's the carrying of a weapon in an open manner that really would deter any crime. If Mr. Dundon had clearly carried the weapon openly, I think he would have been in a better position to ward off any would-be robbers or assailants.
Ms. Herman, if Mr. Dundon had carried that weapon openly as he went into the bank, what do you think the security officer would have done then?
I'm quite certain that he would have at least been stopped and questioned. I highly doubt he would have just been able to waltz into the bank going unnoticed.
I doubt that also. Don't you think he would have endangered himself by walking in with the gun in hand?
I think the security guard was watching him and saw him from the moment he pulled into the parking lot and got out of his car. I think that the security guard would have probably approached him if he saw that he was clearly displaying the weapon openly and approaching the bank. I think the security guard probably would have approached him and and, you know, sort of checked out the situation.
With weapon drawn counsel?
Yeah, that defies common sense counsel, that someone would walk into the bank with a pistol in their hand and not be threatened or considered to be threatened. I mean, that's what...
I agree.
I asked opposing counsel how you would carry a weapon. And that goes to the, quote, concealing or partially concealing. And if you don't have it holstered, and he was carrying it, as I understand it, on his belt, and in a, quote, a less threatening position than having a gun in your hand when you walk into a bank.
Well, I agree. I mean, if he's just holding the weapon in his hand and he's approaching the bank, that certainly is... appears to be a threatening situation, but it's my understanding of the law in Wisconsin, as long as the gun would have been in a holster clipped to his belt and not covered by his shirt, which is the problem in this case. The security guard officer, the bank security guard, saw Mr. Dundon put the gun on his belt or tuck it into his waistband and pull his shirt over it. It wasn't openly displayed, and I believe openly displayed in Wisconsin allows for the carrying of the gun in a holster on the belt.
Well, as I understand your position, you're arguing not to the facts of this case, but your position would, for instance, not allow Justice Prosser, let's assume Justice Prosser gets a phone call at 7 o'clock this morning, and he's got he tapes it, and he's threatened. He says, on the way into work, you're going to get yours. And so Justice Prosser puts a gun on the seat of his car on his way into work. Now, putting it just on the seat of the car is a violation of the CCW, right?
Correct. It's my understanding of the law.
And you're saying that if he was arrested and that gun was found, he would not be able to assert the privilege of under 93945.
As the law stands now, there is no privilege that would apply.
And you're saying that he shouldn't be able to, as a matter of policy, because you're making a policy argument to this question.
Right. I believe that's true, because the state's position is that allowing people to do what you're suggesting Justice Prosser might choose to do if someone called him and threatened him, carry the gun, allows citizens to go armed anytime they feel threatened or anytime they feel danger.
The reason I put it in such specifics, maybe I shouldn't use it, use me, is because of the imminency. I mean, there is an imminent danger to me coming in to work in the morning. And nevertheless, you say I must remain unarmed.
Well, it's the state's position that's right. You must remain unarmed because all of the statutory privileges that exist now, and even if this court were to create a common law privilege under the Coleman test, he would still have to have had no reasonable legal alternative. All of the existing statutory privileges require that you only do the otherwise unlawful act if that was really the only option that you had. I mean, you had no other available remedy.
So you're saying you should have called the police department?
Right.
Or stayed home?
Right.
Or called security, gotten his own bodyguard?
Right.
Those are reasonably legal alternatives.
Right.
You can't go armed with a concealed weapon.
No.
Exactly. Because that's just creates violence in the community.
Exactly. Puts more guns on the street.
That's the state's decision.
And that would be, and I think sounds like a very good argument. Here, as coming back to the offer of proof or making a record, this was not allowed to be, any alternative situation was not allowed because the judge said there wasn't the imminence in this case. There wasn't the imminent threat to you. Therefore, you can't put this in.
At the post-conviction point,
that's
what the post-conviction judge decided, just looked at the first element of the Coleman test and said it's just not met here, there's no imminence.
Is weapon defined in the statute? Does it pertain only to a gun?
I believe the statute reads anyone who goes armed with a dangerous weapon, and I believe that is defined. Dangerous weapon is defined. I can't tell you.
Well, I'm just thinking of the impact if we should say there's no privilege. What about women in going home late at night carrying a weapon in their purse for fear that they are going to be assaulted? You would say that that's not a privilege then. That no privilege can exist, even if there's been three rapes in the area in the last three nights.
Right. It's the state's position that people should not just be able to arm themselves anytime they feel unsafe or threatened.
Does it cover sprays?
Unfortunately, I don't know the exact definition of dangerous weapon. I would assume that it would exclude protective sprays, which I believe are legal in Wisconsin.
Counsel, if I understand the state's argument, regardless of what the evidence was here, it just can't be put in to show a defense, because your position is there is no defense, right? So the only time this evidence could be put in would be for some other element, namely if there was mens rea, that is intent, or whether it was concealed or not, and that kind of thing. But your position is you don't have to look at any of this evidence. You don't have to look at imminent. You don't have to look at any of that because there is no such defense. Now, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I do want to understand the state's position.
That is correct. That's the state's position. There simply is no defense of privilege in Wisconsin, nor should there be. It's the state's position.
But that's your first position, and right. You have an alternative position.
Right. My alternative position is if this court decides there should be a defense of privilege in the state of Wisconsin.
And that would be by our developing the common law, right?
Right, that would have to fall under that catch-all.
And so then you'd have to read that catch-all to the future common law development as well as past common law development.
Right. Okay. Which right. I believe, the state was able to do this court did create a common law privilege in the Pullman case, even though there was no common law in this state.
That's right. But found it elsewhere.
Right.
Go ahead.
I'm assuming you would then like me to go to alternative argument. Sure. As I stated earlier, it's the state's position that if this court decides to create a common law privilege to the charge of carrying concealed weapon, then the state asks this court to apply a clarified version of the narrow Pullman privilege. And as you are aware, there are five elements to this Coleman test, and in the state's brief, the state requested a few clarifications. And the clarifications were in the first, second, and third elements, specifically in elements 1 and 3, the unlawful present imminent danger, threat, and whether there was a reasonable legal alternative. The state asks this court to change the language, clarify the language of that statute, of those two elements, to bring it in line with the language of the existing statutory privilege, to require both a subjective element, and that subjective feeling is objectively reasonable.
And you now read this Coleman test as the alternative? Is that what your objection is?
The state believes that one possible reading of the Coleman test as it exists now allows for a defendant to show either that the defendant was under an unlawful present imminent threat, or so objectively, if the fact finder could find that objectively, yeah, there was a threat, that would be enough, or if the defendant subjectively believed that and that was objectively reasonable.
And you want to replace the or with an and? Is that a correct statement?
That would be a correct statement. The specific reading of the elements that I asked for, that the state asked for in the brief, was to clarify element 1, and element 3 would be similar. The defendant reasonably believed he or she was under an unlawful, present, imminent, and impending threat. And element 3, the defendant reasonably believed he or she had no reasonable legal alternative. That requires the language reasonably believed has within it the requirement that he believed it and that it was objectively reasonable. And it's the state's position that that's how the other privileges now read.
Now, when you say you want to change it, do you want to change it for the Coleman case situation and this one, or you don't care about Coleman?
I don't care about Coleman, no, necessarily for the purpose of this case, but I think maybe a clarification would apply to both cases the test is basically the same, and the clarification would probably clear up any ambiguities as to what Coleman stands for.
Counsel,
I'm sorry.
Please go ahead.
I was going to get to the additional requested clarification that the state has asked for, which is with regard to element 2, that the defendant did not recklessly or negligently place him or herself in the situation. The state asks this court to slightly modify this element to require that the defendant was not engaged in an unlawful activity at the time he or she carried a concealed weapon, so as to prohibit anyone who intentionally arms themselves with a concealed weapon for the purposes of committing a separately unlawful act, such as drug dealing or robbery. They cannot claim this privilege. That would make it clear that if someone is engaging in a separately unlawful act and carrying a concealed weapon for the purpose of doing so, they cannot then claim this privilege.
Is that in lieu of number two, or is it an add-on?
It's an add-on. I believe...
You keep the reckless language, then.
With the state's requested modification, element two would read, as it does, basically, with an add-on, the defendant did not recklessly or negligently place himself or herself in a situation in which it was possible that he or she would be forced to carry a concealed weapon and was not engaged in an unlawful activity at the time he or she carried the concealed weapon. So it just adds on that modification at the end of the existing language.
Counsel,
yes.
Could I go to a different issue? I am still not clear in my mind exactly what, once the gentleman got out of the automobile, how was the weapon concealed?
Could you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
How was the weapon, what is the evidence of how the weapon was concealed after the defendant got out of his automobile?
The evidence at trial, there were two, the state offered two witnesses. One was the bank security guard, who testified that he saw Mr. Dundon approach in his vehicle. He saw Mr. Dundon get out of his vehicle, grab the gun off the seat of the car. He saw Mr. Dundon place the weapon in the waistband of his pants, and he testified then that he saw Mr. Dundon pull his shirt over the waistband, concealing the weapon. And I believe the bank vice president also testified that when he saw Mr. Dundon, he did not see Mr. Dundon until he came into the bank, but the bank vice president testified that when the police approached Mr. Dundon, he had to adjust his shirt to reveal the butt end of the weapon, that his shirt was covering it, essentially. They both testified to the same thing as far as the concealment.
So there was a point, according to the evidence, that the gun could not be seen at all?
Right. The bank security guard testified that the shirt was completely covering it, and the bank vice president testified that Mr. Dundon had to adjust his shirt to reveal it, which suggests that it was completely covered until he lifted up his shirt or moved his shirt when the police approached him.
Didn't the defendant testify that he didn't intend to conceal it?
I believe he tried to testify to that effect. He said that he put the gun on his waistband and that it was openly displayed, but he did admit that it was partially concealed by his belt, but he testified that his shirt was already tucked in when he placed the gun in his belt, so that he didn't conceal it with his shirt. But he did argue, or excuse me, he did testify that it was at least partially concealed by his belt.
What is partially concealed mean?
I'm not exactly sure what partially concealed means, but I believe what the prosecutor was trying to establish was that in order to not be concealed, my understanding of the law is that it has to be, I forget the exact language, but basically visible to the ordinary observer or something to that effect. And partial concealment, I guess, suggests that it's not visible to the ordinary observer. And I believe there's case law in Wisconsin that holds that partial concealment, as long as the weapon is not ordinarily visible, is enough to meet the element of concealment.
Ms. Sherman, let's go back to something that Justice Wilcox was talking about earlier, which continues to trouble me. We've, in several cases, told trial judges and told attorneys that where there's an objection, the objection is sustained, and they want to make a record that the right way to do it is to make an offer of proof outside of the presence of the jury. Now, if we buy your argument, aren't we running counter to our own cases? You're saying what the trial judge here was did here was perfectly all right, because really there was no privilege that applied. So therefore, it was perfectly okay to say to the defense attorney, no offer of proof, no record.
That is correct, but I believe what the state's position is in this case is that Mr. Dundon's trial counsel really didn't even try to make an offer of proof. He did not at any point say, I would like to make an offer of proof on a defense of privilege.
Didn't he say, I want to make a record?
And the I believe judge at some point he did say, I would like to make a record, but...
And the judge said, I'm going to hold you in contempt if you continue to try to make a record?
At one point, that was, in fact, what the trial court did. But the trial court did allow Mr. Dundon's trial counsel to explain at great length. I believe it takes up about 10 pages of the transcript, where Mr. Dundon's trial counsel was given the opportunity, and there was lengthy discussion, on this defense of necessity that he was trying to establish. He was able to elaborate on that quite at length, and the prosecutor was able to explain to the trial counsel why the defense of necessity did not apply. So there was opportunity for Mr. Dundon's trial counsel to try and establish some defense of privilege.
When was that? Was that at the instructions conference?
No, it was during the testimony of Mr. Dundon, the defendant, when his trial counsel was trying to ask him these questions that were repeatedly objected to by the prosecutor. It was at that point that I'm not sure at who decided that. I mean, I don't know if the defense counsel asked for it, if the trial counsel just said, listen, we're going off the record and we're going into chambers, but that is what happened.
What troubles me is that it didn't seem ordinarily, having been a trial judge 13 years, it's ordinary that I could remember that I'm going to threaten someone with contempt if they try to make a record. So it gets some flavor of what was coming through. And that's the reason I asked the question. That seemed to be an unusual response.
Well, I would agree that it is, that what the trial court did here was maybe, you know, out of the ordinary, but I think the trial court was correct that there was no defense of privilege, so all of this testimony was completely irrelevant, and that's why it sustained the state's objections.
Well, let's assume the trial court erred, that the trial court should have allowed an offer of proof, and that the trial court erred in not doing that. Isn't it harmless error if you're right, if the state's right? The state's right that there's no privilege and this evidence shouldn't have come in. So the trial court erred.
Who's I believe heard? That would be correct.
Be harmless.
Right.
If you're right.
Right. I see that my time is up, but if there are other questions.
There is another question, Justice Bradley.
One of my concerns with the position that you take as your number one position, that there is no privilege at all, is this, and it was the hypotheticals that were developed earlier. Let's say I got a death threat. Let's say someone escaped from a mental institution and law enforcement advised me that this person was after me. And let's say my son's karate instructor gave me some kind of a metal device to keep in my purse, and that the metal device was actually designed to cause bodily harm. Under that fact situation, I could be charged with carrying a concealed weapon. Is that correct?
Correct.
And I would be found guilty of carrying a concealed weapon. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's the state's position that there is no defense of privilege in Wisconsin. There's no statutory privilege, and if there is, that needs to come from the legislature. And the law in Wisconsin has been constant for 120 years as far as strictly prohibiting the carrying of concealed weapons. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you. Mr. Coleman, you have approximately 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Justice Bradley, I think you'd have the opportunity to at least develop the facts of that and attempt to establish the five elements of the Coleman defense and establish a prima facie evidence of those five elements, allow the jury to decide whether you're guilty of carrying a concealed weapon or not. And that's what Mr. Dundon's asking for here. I want to make clear that Mr. Dundon's attorney asked, in essence, for a Coleman-type instruction originally. He called it necessity, but he based that on the federal common law necessity, which broadly states what the Coleman defense is, and that is in the record at item 33. His request was, in order to find a defendant acted out of necessity, you must find the defendant reasonably believed that his conduct was necessary to avoid harm, which was more serious than the act committed, and that the defendant did not have a reasonable legal alternative. And I would suggest to the court that the Coleman privilege defense is a mere refinement of that defense that he asked the judge, and there were extensive discussions in the chambers about that, and the judge made it perfectly clear that he didn't use this term, but it's clear from the record, I think, that carrying a concealed weapon is an absolute liability defense. If you meet the three elements, you're guilty, end of story. And that's what the judge ruled, that's what the state argued. Mr. Dundon was not permitted to argue the contrary, and that's what he asked that he be permitted to do.
What should we do with the case, counsel? Do you think, should we send it back for an evidentiary here, or just to allow you to make an offer of proof?
I think the appropriate relief would be a new trial, Your Honor, to avoid piecemeal litigation and
why do we need a new trial if, in fact, your offer of proof does not rise to the level of the Coleman elements? If you can't meet, for instance, the element of imminency.
Well, there's a danger you to have a subsequent appeal from any denial of that ability to go forward with the defense. And I think also that all this evidence, Your Honor, was relevant to whether, in fact, Mr. Dundon did conceal the